This conference will
We're talking about the abused woman. That is strengths, characteristics, qualities, features that we very likely haven't considered because the last person that we know terribly well is ourselves. We think we do, and we always look at the same things. So tonight, it's about getting a much clearer perspective of a lot of features about you. Of course you're an individual, but as abusive men share characteristics and features, so too do abused women. But they tend to be a lot nicer. So I would like to start by telling you a little bit about a woman I met in a specific circumstances, and her name was Jane. She was one of those people I find a little challenging to deal with. She brought the mood of the meeting I was speaking to right down in about a minute. I'd been talking to a Women's Institute group about domestic violence, and I'd ended on an upbeat note focusing on the very real possibility of healing, as well as sharing what we can all do to educate women and girls and break the mold of domestic abuse. Jane didn't believe in the possibility of healing. She said, "You never get over what you've been through. You'll never feel really good about yourself. I left my violent husband 13 years ago. I've had a good relationship with a partner since, but you know, you still feel worthless. It stays with you for the rest of your life." Whew, that brought the tone down. But what was actually going on with Jane? The fact is, Jane had got out, but she had never broken free, because those two things are not necessarily a result of one another. Jane was still living her life within the mold of abuse. She was still living in abuse world. She went on to say that the emotional abuse she had endured was worse than the physical violence. "The emotional abuse scars you for life," she said. "I used to be a nice person, but I'm mouthy now." Now that was the first time she'd used the I form. The rest of the time she was talking in the second person about you when she meant I. Jane was, I have to say, a complete energy drain. Because she had never broken free of the misery of her abusive relationship, she needed to make other people experience. She was, of course, deserving of our compassion and deserving of my compassion. It was obviously therapeutic for her to be talking about her experience, even if it conveyed an unnecessarily negative message about what lies ahead for abuse survivors. But Jane was also an embodiment of all that is best and, to my eyes, worst about an abused woman. Now, when I say worst, what I mean is saddest. That is the only judgment that I have any right to pass. But let's look at this for a moment. What did I find so sad about Jane? Three things. First, her comment, repeated three times within 10 minutes, that she used to be a nice person, but abuse had made her very much less nice. That was her belief, at any rate. Was it true? Of course it wasn't. That was what her abusive partner had brainwashed her to swallow, and she had. Second, there was the repeated use of the word you to describe her reality. You could argue that this was indicative of dissociation, and in a sense it is. But something else was going on, I believe. Jane had done what we all unconsciously do. She had generalized. What she believed was true for her held true for the whole world. The third thing was even sadder. When I asked her what she had done about getting healing, she looked at me, and all she said was, "I thought I had to go through this alone." What beliefs and attitudes do you think that you and Jane share? This is the key. Jane didn't really know who she was anymore. She believed she was the shadow of a person her abusive partner had told her that she was. And in that, Jane was like every abused woman I have ever met who has struggled to cope with emotional abuse alone. If she had ever known what her strengths and qualities were, and that is quite a big if, she had long since lost sight of them. She didn't see them as an integral part of her. As she saw it, they were aspects of herself that had been worn away by her abusive husband's constant assaults. Jane relied on her feelings to know what was true about her, and she felt terrible. What made her think she could rely on her feelings to know what was true about her? Her abusive husband had spent years and years deliberately working on subverting her feelings about herself. Remember, the head worker's role is to brainwash you into feeling like a waste of space. So let's think about it for a moment. How reliable an indication are your feelings? And let's be very clear that your feelings and your intuition are two completely different things. Think about the way intuition works. Intuition just kicks in, does it not? Your intuition is that little voice that pops up and tells you something out of the blue. Your intuition may surprise you with what it comes up with. Your intuition doesn't really carry a feeling charge. It doesn't radically change your mood. Most commonly, it just presents you with a conundrum. It throws up the answer, especially when you haven't even consciously asked yourself the question. What's more, it throws up the right answer, as you've doubtless discovered more than once with the benefit of hindsight. But intuition doesn't tell you how it got there. And since your thinking is going along a completely different track, you can't understand how your intuition arrived at that answer. So here's one key feature of abused women that costs them dear. They question their intuition. They ask their intuition to do the one thing it is not equipped to do, and that is explain itself. When it comes to it, do you insist on your abusive partner explaining himself to your satisfaction? Of course you don't, because it's not going to happen. At a certain point, you just swallow what he says because you're too tired or needy to do otherwise. But when it comes to your poor, overlooked intuition, which is probably your best friend in the world, you give it a hard time. And your intuition withdraws, leaving you, like Jane, at the mercy of your untrustworthy feelings. Why shouldn't you trust your feelings? Listen carefully, because this is important. Have your feelings ever told you that you love a partner who has mistreated you every which way? Not all the time, perhaps, but enough of the time. Are your feelings telling you the whole truth? Of course you're not. Of course they're not, sorry. Your feelings are working to make you right. You'll tolerate an awful lot from someone you believe that you love, because the love makes it all right-ish. But suppose you tell yourself that your partner is not simply acting like a brute a lot of the time. He really is a heartless brute who hasn't cared about your happiness for years and is interested in hurting you. Can you honestly say you love that person? Can you honestly say that you can find much to love about him in the here and now? Or do your feelings of love kick in to safeguard the dream about the man he once was or might be, and the life you could have together if you could just wave a magic wand and cast the right spell over him? If you could just focus his mind on turning back into the man you once thought he was? I've heard so many abused women describe how horrible their partners are in great detail. And I have to agree, they sound perfectly revolting. But then they add, "But I still love him." That's not unconditional love. That's denial. Jane's done it. I've certainly done it. And I'll bet money that you've done it also. Speaking personally, it was a great relief when I realized that I did not love the man my husband was or had become, although I was still attached to aspects of our life together. It was a great relief to realize that it was okay for me to dislike him heartily. It strikes me as perfectly reasonable to dislike someone who has your worst interests at heart? We all end up more or less like Jane, whether we've been with an abusive partner for months, years, or decades. And obviously, we're different individuals with different histories, different tastes, and different gifts. But here's the thing, we have an awful lot of common ground. Abusive men might as well be clones. I don't think the same is true for abused women, but we do share various key features that make us vulnerable to abuse in the first place. First, as a breed, we tend to be people pleasers. Pleasing other people is very, very important to us. Not that there's anything wrong in wanting to be accommodating and agreeable, there isn't, provided it's not a one-way street. How did you learn to be a people pleaser? The chances are it all started in childhood. Parents and or teachers most probably taught you to be a good little girl. That meant doing what you were told and behaving in specific ways to get your parents' approval. Whether you actually got their approval or not is another matter. As a child, doing what you could to get your family's love and attention was a thoroughly sensible strategy. You were trying to make your environment as good as it could possibly be. Still, there are certain things that parents and teachers don't say to children, especially young children. They don't say, behave well and thoughtfully towards other people and expect thoughtful behavior in return. In part, they don't say that because the child is not of an age to make a whole lot of sense of it. In part, their life is made much easier by having a well-behaved child, period. But what happens? Quite often there are no rewards or no significant rewards for being a good little child. The message the child takes from that is that they just have to try harder. So they get very good at trying harder to please, and they still don't get the payoff they long for. What happens when they grow up? That child, more often than not a girl, still behaves like the good little girl. Nobody told that little girl that the rules change when she grows up. So she believes that her childhood map of how to behave is the map by which she still has to live. She also believes, despite all the evidence to the contrary, that if she people pleases furiously enough, she will have to be rewarded sooner or later. And she can wait. It can be a long, long wait, can't it? But here's the thing. Now she's become used to going out of her way to please other people and expecting little or nothing in return. And that makes her an attractive target for an abuser. Put yourself for a moment in an abuser's shoes if you possibly can. If you're self-centered and in need of someone to exercise power and control over, you couldn't do better than choose a people pleaser, could you? At least half the work of breaking that person into your way of thinking has already been done for you. When Jane said she was no longer the nice person she had once been, it wasn't true. Somewhere along the line, she'd stopped having to do nice, that is, she'd stopped having to please people compulsively, and doubtless those people who had exploited her niceness had complained and punished her for that. And that leads me on to the second common feature of abused women, overdone strength. Maybe you feel that people-pleasing and niceness are weaknesses on your part. I beg to differ. When I first heard the expression, there are no weaknesses, only overdone strength, I felt a weight lift from my shoulders. If there were no weaknesses, only overdone strengths, then I couldn't be weak and pathetic. Not that I had a clue what my overdone strengths were any more than you probably do right now. And if you're still struggling with the concept of overdone strengths, think about the expression, generous to a fault. What do we mean by it? To me, it means being generous to the point of harming, depriving, or shortchanging yourself. All our overdone strengths are qualities that are exercised in exactly the same way, to the point of harming, depriving, or shortchanging ourselves. Some of the overdone strengths of abused women include loyalty, love, long-sufferingness, self-sacrifice, trust, optimism, and hope. In a word, we massively over-exercise these strengths in our relationship with a partner who is unworthy of them. In an abusive relationship, we stick with our partner through thin and thinner because we are excessively loyal, loving, self-sacrificing, trusting, and optimistic. Well, as for hope, we become hopium addicts, addicted to the hope of a better future, constantly looking forward to receiving the fix of love from our partner one day that will justify the years of misery and ill treatment. Why do we do it? Why don't we do the same thing, down tools, pack our suitcases, and leave? Sure, there are the practical problems, dependent children, lack of money and fear, to name but a few. And underpinning these problems lies something even more debilitating. In Breaking the Argument Cycle, Sharon Rifkin describes her own reluctance to break off her relationship with a head worker, which led to the revelation, because of my earlier experiences, I had a wound of not trusting my own perceptions and beliefs. Like Rifkin, I had, and to a degree still have, a wound of not trusting my own perceptions and beliefs. And I'm guessing you do too. If we always find someone whose teeth fit our wounds, then if you have a wound of not trusting your own perceptions and beliefs, you're bound to meet up with a head worker who gains his control over you by making you doubt yourself. So those are some of the key features of abused women. And because it's often difficult to separate your worst case scenario about who you might be from the person you truly are, I thought it would be helpful to describe the 8 personas of abused women. You're bound to notice a degree of overlap between one persona and the next, and that's okay. But if these personas help you to identify when you cease to be you, the individual, and slip into your abused woman programming, that will help you to move forward. So, here we go. Persona number 1, the martyr. The martyr has been told never, ever to put herself and her own needs first. And you know what? She never does. Self-sacrifice is her game. She's only ever comfortable, in as much as she ever is comfortable, doing things for other people. That includes people she doesn't particularly know well. In fact, not only does she not need to know people well, she doesn't even need to like them necessarily. She's a fantastic resource for her entire community. If they want something done or someone to help them out, they know they can rely on the martyr. She just can't say no, no matter how much trouble they put her to. Her thinking is that if she does enough for other people, eventually they will have to be grateful and pay her back. When it doesn't happen, she gets confused. They're not playing by the rules, she is internalized. Occasionally, she may get frustrated and angry about it. Usually, though, she doesn't get angry enough to stand up for herself. But when she does voice her frustration, she can expect people to take offense and pull away from her. Martyrs surround themselves with takers. They don't mean to do that. Why would they? But takers will always come out of the woodwork when they find a martyr. Not all martyrs go to quite such lengths. It took me a long time to discover that I was a martyr too, because I wouldn't do anything for just anyone. I had my limits. There were a couple of people I could say no to, but I still did most things for most people. Giving selflessly to people was one of the few things that made me feel better about myself. Not a lot better, but a bit. But like a lot of abused women, I made a very self-destructive trade-off. I was prepared to trade my happiness for my daughter's. I believed, wrongly, that staying in an abusive marriage was the best thing for my daughter, as it would give her an unbroken family. I would buy her happiness at the price of my own. Sadly, it doesn't work like that. Not only is an unhappy mother a lousy role model for a daughter or a son, but I couldn't shield my daughter from all the effects of growing up in an abusive household. The only happy ending to martyrdom, as I understand it, is in religious stories where martyrs end up as saints. The reality is a little different. I never achieved saintly status. If anything, my daughter experienced my self-sacrifice as a burden, something that she felt responsible for and guilty about. In the real world, martyrdom is a thankless position. The time comes when martyrs realize that they have been so selfless that they are left with nothing. Martyrdom simply drains them of their identity. One day they will wake up feeling empty and aggrieved. And the only thing worse than a martyr is an embittered martyr. The other thing that happens is that martyrs become victims. Now, we've all been victims of an abusive partner. But something unpleasant happens to us when we internalize that victim status, when we slap the victim label on ourselves. One thing is we feel very, very sorry for ourselves. So we go on and on about the awful things that have been done to us. And while what we say may be true, it really isn't helpful, because when we see ourselves as victims, we feel and become powerless. As victims, we get to dump all the blame for what has happened to us on our abusive partner, which may be a small gratification, but it leaves us utterly disempowered. For us to feel powerful, we have to take responsibility. Not for abusive partner's behavior, certainly, because he's responsible for his own behavior. But we're responsible for our own vulnerability, for our fear, and for the choices that we make. We can only change what we own. We all made the decision to stay with an abusive partner for the best reasons we had at the time. Maybe we did it because we thought nobody else would ever want us, or we didn't deserve any better. Still, whatever the reason, we made a bad decision. That is our responsibility. It was a mistake that has cost us dear, but it's never too late to learn from our mistakes and build a much happier life. The martyr and the victim can't do that. Their martyrdom and their victimhood paralyze them. All they can do is sigh wearily and state that, for them, it's all over. When they do that, unwittingly, they dig themselves even deeper into the misery of an abusive relationship. Without meaning to, they collude with their abuser. Persona number two, the general manager of the universe. Now, there's a fine irony about this persona. The abused woman feels powerless, and yet she is constantly trying to manage her partner's view of the world, of her, and of the relationship. She does everything she can to make him see things from her perspective, and he's not interested. He does not share her worldview. Why would he? He refuses to see that she has rights and a point of view too, because as far as he's concerned, she doesn't. He holds her solely responsible for the relationship problems. In short, she is trying to persuade a tyrant to treat her like an equal. She is trying to get a sworn enemy to treat her as a valued friend and to transform a situation of power and control into an intimate, loving relationship. Her efforts would probably be better spent trying to end world poverty or clean up the BP oil leak single-handed. She also spends immense amounts of time and energy trying to transform her abuser into the person she knows he can be. If there are children involved, she tries to manage the way they view their father and the situation they experience in the home. And I suppose you could also say that she is in charge of PR for the family unit, which can be another extremely tough job. Many women expend huge amounts of time and energy projecting the myth of a successful relationship and covering up how bad things really are. General manager of the universe is an unpaid job for which the abused woman gets no thanks at all. In fact, since her efforts are doomed to failure, since she can't get the staff who will work with her, not against her, her efforts always fall short of her partner's and her own expectations. So she has massive responsibility with zero power. No wonder she feels like a total failure. The general manager of the universe doesn't know that this is a job that she can resign from at any time. She regards it as a life sentence. Nobody's told her otherwise. Persona number 3, Little Miss Perfect. On the fateful night when I joined the domestic violence support group, I walked into a room full of my peers, other abused women, and the first thing that struck me was how different they looked from what I had imagined. What had I expected? Well, I'd expected a load of washed-out drudges. That's because I thought that emotional abuse was something that only happened to underprivileged women somewhere a long, long way from where I lived. What I saw were other well-groomed, attractive, tastefully dressed women. It was ironic, really, because I was well-groomed and well-dressed and well into denial when I walked in. So were most of the other women there. Because abused women have so little sense of self and of their own worth, they often go to more trouble than their more confident sisters to present themselves attractively. That's not always true, certainly, but it's been my experience that even when things are really, really tough for abused women, they'll expend energy they don't have in presenting themselves attractively to the world. Having been brought up without a sense of her own value, an abused woman knows that she has to make a massive effort to please other people at all times. That knowledge is, of course, reinforced by her abusive partner. She does everything she can to learn from her abuser how to be the best partner she possibly can be. If leaving shoeboxes in the hall upsets him, she'll make an effort not to do it again. But next time he tells her not to leave the washing longer than an hour in the washing machine after the cycle is finished, because otherwise it will smell. So she takes that on board too. And if he tells her to have the children in bed by the time he gets home so as not to irritate him when he's tired, she'll do that too. But still, that's not enough. Try as she might, she still slips up. It could be there's the tone of voice she uses, allegedly, or whether a dinner that meets with his approval is on the table when he gets home, or how long she needs him to unwind after he gets home before she may speak to him. There are the thousand rules she tries to take on board so as not to trigger his anger so she can keep him sweet. But all her efforts are doomed to failure, because there will always be something else that infuriates the abuser, or a rule that she couldn't quite juggle successfully together with all the others. Little Miss Perfect is the persona intended to meet the abuser's demanding standards and make her lovable to him. But Little Miss Perfect is never going to be perfect enough. You're human, so your efforts are doomed to failure. Some women have cosmetic surgery to make themselves more physically attractive to an abusive partner. That never works for very long either. Little Miss Perfect was a persona that started in childhood. It was a persona that didn't work terribly well even then. Little Miss Perfect might have annoyed a cold, angry parent or other adult slightly less than the spontaneous, natural child would have done. But it wasn't enough to turn that adult into a loving parent. Because Little Miss Perfect couldn't do it. If the adult was cold and unloving, nothing was going to change that. Being Little Miss Perfect will never be enough to get the love you seek from an abusive partner. Nothing will ever be enough for an abusive man. His unspoken contract is to find fault with you. In fact, the Little Miss Perfect persona grew out of the need to stop an adult finding fault with you. It never worked because the adult fault finder was dumping their negativity at your door. Being Little Miss Perfect only prolongs the agony of not being good enough just by being you. It perpetuates the misery of delegating to a hostile other the power to confer lovableness on you. Persona number 4. The Healer. Did you think he was Superman when you first met him? Or did you find out very quickly that he had his wounds and his hurts too? And were you moved by them? Did you want to heal them? Or was it just me? Only joking. It's something I hear from women time and time again. They were attracted by their partner's wounds and his frailties. Their partner's vulnerability and neediness holds all sorts of hooks for them, just as they did for me. When I met my husband, he was struggling to break free of an overbearing smother mother that he idolized. He'd already been through one near nervous breakdown. He was struggling with his concentration camp survivor heritage and the difficult experience of growing up with two extremely dysfunctional parents. He was neurotic, needy, and brash. And he wore purple trousers. A sane young woman would have turned tail and run. But not me. Oh, no. What did I do? I confused his vulnerability with openness to intimacy. Underestimating his wounds and my own, I thought my love could heal him. How I cringe at admitting that as an older, wiser person. Somewhere in my overheated heart, I also thought that through healing him, I'd be able to heal myself without actually having to do the work on myself, without focusing on myself. And before you say it, it's absolutely true. The urge to heal other people is still very, very strong in me. It's still one of those things that provide me with a sense of meaning. But now I have acquired appropriate tools and wisdom. I now know that I cannot heal anyone without a fair degree of attachment on my part, and certainly without a fair degree of consentment and commitment on theirs. And with the wisdom born of experience, I now know not to confuse my emotional life with my professional life. What I've learned is that we cannot heal the people we love. All we can do is love them. And if we cannot accept them the way they are, wounds and all, then we do not truly love them in a way that is nurturing and healthy for them. But if you accept that we all look for love on this earth because it is a natural human need, and we want someone with whom we can safely open our hearts and our being, if you accept that we want to feel whole and unconditionally loved and accepted by a partner, then that automatically disqualifies truly loving an abuser, or at the very least, loving him in a hands-on way. We cannot truly, unconditionally love someone whose agenda is to smash us to pieces, whether psychologically or physically. Much as he loves playing for the sympathy vote. Your abusive partner has no intention of healing himself anytime soon, and he certainly doesn't want you to do it for him. Persona number 5, Cinderella. When you stop to think about it, which you probably didn't because you got too sucked in by the happy ending, Cinderella is a bit of a victim. Cinderella has had a hard time of it. She lost her beloved mother, and her father betrayed her by marrying a cold, calculating bitch with 2 vile daughters. Cinderella is meek and loyal and patient and long-suffering and dutiful, as well as beautiful, even in her rags. Now, in fairy tales, these qualities are all great pluses. When you stop to think about it, Cinderella's meekness, loyalty, patience, long-sufferingness, and her sense of duty are all overdone strengths. In practice, they reduce her to being a drudge or a workhorse. What's more, as we shall see, her beauty wasn't such a great advantage either. Now, we all know that when the prince saw her all kitted out in her fairy godmother's best, so to speak, he fell in love with her. But the truth is, had she not found her way to the palace looking breathtakingly well-groomed and privileged, he would never have stumbled upon her in the first place. Running off as she did, and leaving a glass slipper behind, which was not her choice, it was what she had to do, was the best move she could possibly have made, because it created a sense of irresistible mystery about her. How could the prince not want to pursue her? It's what men are programmed to do. They hunt the creatures that hide from them. Do you really think that if he'd met her for the first time in her sad rags, exhibiting all of those massively overdone strengths in her quietly unassuming way, he'd have fallen in love with her? Not a hope in hell. He wouldn't have noticed her. So how do you think the story really ended? For my money, this is how it had to turn out. The prince whips her off to the palace and marries her forthwith before he's got a chance to find out what she's really like. Poor Cinderella can't believe her luck. She can't believe that a prince has married her. The only sense that she can make of it is that he loves her for being the self-effacing, sweet, virtuous, dutiful, long-suffering, uncomplaining girl she is. Boy, is she wrong. So she carries on being Cinderella, and it doesn't take too long before 2 things happen. First, he gets bored. When she was mysterious, he was curious. But Little Miss Sweetness and Light is not 1,000 miles from Little Miss Perfect. She's biddable, and she is boring. The reality, from the prince's point of view, falls way short of the fantasy. Second, she still acts like Cinderella. So before too long, he starts treating her like Cinderella. He orders her about a bit. She takes it meekly, the kind of thing she's used to. He puts her down. She swallows it. We've all done the Cinderella bit to some degree, and it doesn't work. People who are happy to exploit Cinderellas are 10 a penny. Fairy godmothers are, to the best of my knowledge at least, like hen's teeth. Cinderella never attracted the happy ending into her life for being Cinderella. Being Cinderella was really a one-way street into a lifetime of drudgery. It was only when she stopped acting like Cinderella that she attracted a different kind of attention. Now, I don't want to labour the message, but I will anyway. You've lived long enough to know that nobody is going to come along out of the blue and rescue you from yourself as much as anything else. So since being Cinderella doesn't work, it's time to start seeing yourself as a very much more attractive kind of heroine at the very center of your own life. Persona number 6, the orphan. The day finally came when my ex-husband was open and honest about what he'd wanted in a wife and what had attracted him to me. I'd love to say it was my personality, but it wasn't. Not really. Nor was it my looks. Although if I hadn't measured up to his fairly exacting requirements, I'd never have got a first date. The first thing that I had that he really wanted was something he only admitted in therapy many years later. I was an orphan. He'd been looking for an orphan. He had to do some work over the years to maintain the estrangement from my family, but the existing alienation between them and me when he first met me was something that really appealed to him. It's so much easier to dominate someone if they lack the support of a family, is it not? You'll put up with so much more if you feel you have nowhere and no one to turn to, won't you? The more isolated you are, the greater the hold your abuser has over you. The jailer and the head worker work together on creating a void around you. The jailer will stop you seeing the people who care about you, and the head worker will tell you how other people despise you. When he tells you how little other people think of you, you feel too humiliated to really process what he is saying and make sense of it. Besides, as we've said earlier, you have a wound of not really trusting your own perceptions. So you believe him. You don't test what he says, and you don't realize that it is true playground nastiness. In fact, he's behaving just like a 5-year-old telling you, "I hate you, and so does everyone else." How does he know what everyone else thinks? The sad thing is the degree to which you internalize that sense of being despised and alone. I've heard so many abused women say that if they lose their abusive partner, they will have nothing in their world and their life will be over. They don't even see that they have children who love them and who they love. They have friends and workmates who value them. Often they have work that they do to a very high standard. The truth is that they have a lot in their life and they contribute a lot to life, but they just don't see it. Their abusive partner has blinkered them, and they don't know that they have the right to lift those blinkers from their eyes any time they choose. Every abusive man tries to turn his partner into an orphan. But we cannot be orphaned without our own consent. We all have some friends or family, or at the very least, the possibility of creating new connections. There are always going to be plenty of people out there who will be happy to connect with us. We aren't going to find one person who can give us everything we're looking for. That's not the way we're designed to relate. Actually, we're all social beings. When we get beyond the trance of self-hate, we can find lots of people who will each offer us something precious. In return, we can offer some part of ourselves that will be more precious to them than we can imagine. The orphan persona is very persuasive and extremely destructive. Happily, it is also quite reversible. We are always free to create a family of affection around ourselves. Persona number 7, the perfect mother. Not every abused woman is a mother, but motherhood becomes much more challenging in the context of an abusive relationship. My own experience and that of pretty much every abused woman who is a mother that I've ever worked with is that we have massive, massive guilt. We never stop beating ourselves up for our failures as mothers. We realize that we cannot give our children the perfect home and family environment, whatever that is, and we blame ourselves for it, mercilessly. In part, this relates to the martyr trade-off discussed earlier. If we can make our children's world perfect, then our misery has served for something. In reality, we're setting ourselves an impossible task. First, we've never known the perfect home and family environment. We're already doing well if we can create a more loving, supportive environment than the one we grew up in. When we avoid the worst excesses of our own experience, that's already impressive. We forget that we are constantly struggling to fashion happiness and security for our children out of the destructiveness of a hostile, unforgiving environment. With all our characteristic persistence, we never give up trying to create our very own brand of alchemy. The amazing thing is the degree of success that we achieve. But here's the thing, we're so busy focusing on our duty to our children, and it's certainly true that they never asked to be born into an abusive home. But we're so busy focusing on our duty to our children that we completely lose sight of the fact that we are one person trying to do two people's jobs. Occasionally, women tell me that their abusive partner is a good father. Most of the time, these women are in denial. They are wishing and hoping their partner is a good father. It's very hard admitting to yourself that not only did you mess up by ending up in an abusive relationship, but your partner is a bad father to your children. So there's something that you really need to take on board. Your partner's parenting is his responsibility. It's not yours. If he acts like a bad parent, you can't make him look like a good parent by trying harder yourself. And you can't make your children believe he's a good parent by practicing denial with them. At some level, they know how he's treating them. We may or may not be able to give our children the idyllic childhood we would like them to have. The one thing we can do is we can give them our honesty. You can't make an abusive home perfect for your children. So do yourself a favor and pension off your perfect mother persona today. You'll be much happier when you stop beating yourself up pointlessly for being human, and you will take a burden of guilt off your children's shoulders. Back in the days when I was a martyr, someone told me that I could not make my child's childhood perfect. My perfect mother unsheathed her claws and hissed, "Wanna bet?" I did the very best I could. I fell over myself backwards to do my best, and it was an uneven best. There were fantastic things about it, as my daughter would admit, and there were some pretty low lows too, because I was trying too hard, for too long, with too little support and too little respite for myself. I was drained and running on empty all the time. And being the perfect mother meant that, without meaning to, I imposed on my daughter the burden of feeling that she had to be the perfect daughter, which was a straitjacket for her. Eventually, she reacted against that, understandably. So if it's not your job to be perfect, what is your job? Your job is to be a good enough mother. Your standards are ridiculously high, so you can rest assured that good enough will be more than good enough. But you're not just a mother. You're also a woman and an individual. Your abusive partner is working to destroy your sense of yourself. Proving him wrong is the best revenge. Persona number 8. The romantic. This one can be a little bit difficult to stomach. Abused women live on crumbs of romance and fresh air. We grew up with the mirage of a powerful love that would transport us to a much, much better place emotionally. We got the powerful bit in as much as we ended up in a power-based relationship, albeit as a powerless partner. We didn't get the love we wanted, because we knew so little about what healthy love really is. We didn't know what loving treatment felt like, and so we settle for empty words of love. But still we clutch at the hook of love with bruised and bleeding hands. We obsess over the dream of love, despite all evidence the contrary. And we're blind, self-deluding, and, without wishing to be, self-harming. It really doesn't seem to matter how vilely our partner behaves. We still hold fast to that dream. We manage to split off the real man from the dream. We may dislike and fear the real man, yet we can't let go in case he suddenly changes into the prince we once thought he was. We'll hang around for the odd kind word or the occasional sign of affection, and we'll weave it into a dream sampler. We tell ourselves, one day he'll get to the end of his anger and his insecurities, his addictions and his neuroses, and then we'll be happy together. We tell ourselves, it's a passionate relationship, at least it's not dull. Actually, hanging about waiting for a brute to turn into a prince is about as exciting and meaningful as playing computer games 8 hours a day. We tell ourselves that he's wonderful, really. And if that's wonderful, what on earth is nasty? We tell ourselves he's the sole purveyor of romance in the whole universe. We may fantasize a little about a loving partner, but we know we're being unrealistic. We can't expect ever to attract that kind of partner. We want that kind of partner, but be honest. In your heart of hearts, do you really believe now, at this moment, that you deserve to attract a truly loving partner? I'm guessing like so very many abused women before you, you struggle with that, just as I did. Yet we think we're being realistic when we tell ourselves that a loving relationship could still rise phoenix-like from the ashes of our abusive relationship. The reality is that staying in that relationship allows it to remain absolutely unchanged. My beloved Shih Tzu, Sharon, was put down in my arms eventually because it was the best thing for her. For me, it was one of the hardest things I've ever done. After it was done, I could still see her breathing. I really could see it. It wasn't true, of course, and I knew it, but I could see it. I was that far into denial. It was understandable. Now here's the thing, that's exactly the same kind of denial that we practice when we think that our abusive relationship could yet be transformed into the relationship we want. The loving potential of that relationship is long dead. We just look at it and tell ourselves otherwise. We think that we can breathe life into it, and we hope that lies will be miracles. We hope that the false promises he makes when we finally decide to leave will be the miracle we still hope for. We'll settle for anything at all, provided it croaks, "Prince," at us a few times. We're romantic to a fault. We're not stupid, simply starving. There's no shame in that. It's what's happened to us. It's not who we are. Because we couldn't do anything else in childhood, we accepted that bad things happened to us. When we grew up, we didn't know that we could do any different. Now we do. That's why we can reclaim our lives and our happiness. And after this marathon session, I'd like to open this teleclass up to you for your comments, questions, and observations. So please, feel free to speak up now. If you need to unmute yourself, you just have to press *7. Hello?
I'm still here.
Oh, I'm so glad.
I did mute myself because my birds were going to bed next door, but I'm unmuted now.
Okay. So, thoughts, comments, questions, reflections?
Earlier, maybe it's just my recollection, but I don't remember the manager of the universe being part of the description of an abused woman. And it's so funny because that really, it really hits the nail on the head
for me.
It really does. I try so hard to...
Yes.
Well, you know what? I don't think I started out as an abused woman in this relationship. In fact, I'm sure I didn't. I started out as a neglected woman, yes, which is, I guess, a form of abuse, depending on how you want to look at it. But I did not feel abused. I felt very neglected and very unfulfilled.
Yeah.
When I became a mom is when I became very aware that there was an emotional abuse setting in, and it's become a daily standard now. And trying to get somebody else to see what's going on, it's not going to work. And I didn't realize that. I was in denial about that until I started working with you last fall, was it?
Yeah. And one thing that's quite interesting is that the general manager of the universe was part of the whole description before, and somehow, possibly because you weren't ready to hear it or able to hear it then, it was filtered out.
Mm-hmm. Could be.
Yeah. And although you weren't an abused wife, you had been an abused child. So, you know, the ground was in a sense there.
Oh, yes. Without a doubt.
Yeah. And things were just exacerbated when a child came on the scene, which is what always happens in abusive relationships. There are always points at which they get worse.
Mm-hmm.
If you move in together, things get worse. When you get married, things get worse. If you have children, things get worse because the increasing dependency, which is realistic as your lives mm-hmm. become more entwined, mean that your abuser feels more powerful. And also then, you know, when a child comes along, there are more demands on your affection, and that really is a big one for your principal child.
Right.
Yeah,
I also think it was...
Yeah,
I'm sorry,
carry on.
In my particular case, I also think it was a situation of 20 years. It was just us as a couple.
Yeah.
Then, and I think during that time period, a lot of resentment built up. A lot of...
On whose side?
Feeling, definitely on both sides. But I'm speaking from his point of view, in that he knew that I could have gone on and had a very successful career had I not chosen to come back and marry him. He knew that I had other interests outside the relationship, my work, my, at that time, hobby of designing and creating jewelry. Other friends, other people, travel, all things that he really had no interest in at all. He had no friends outside the relationship. He had no interests outside the relationship, no activities, hobbies, nothing. So I think many times he did feel overshadowed, and I think many times he got very resentful of that. But he couldn't really express it or act it out when it was just the two of us, because then he ran the risk of my not liking him and my not accepting the way he was behaving. So when a third party became involved, it was much easier to triangulate because he didn't need my acceptance anymore, exclusively. He didn't need that exclusively anymore.
That's true.
He was much more interested in pleasing my daughter and has been since the day she entered our lives.
And that's true. And there's value in that exploration, understanding what's happened, and let's come back to you.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the end, you know a fair bit about his truth. And he was basically a child who is holding on to this mommy before your daughter came along.
Sure.
But let's come back to you.
I did
That's
something today.
That's the situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I did something today that may or may not be pivotal. You may recall last August, I did decline a position in New Mexico, which I'm not overly excited about doing. I really don't get overly excited about moving to Albuquerque, New Mexico. However, it is a very good position,
mm-hmm.
and it's a position from which I can start again.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be easy, but I declined it last August because my daughter was just being dismissed from the hospital after having been in the mental health unit for a week. She was then on an outpatient basis for about 3 weeks. I have been trying since then to get her up and running in an employment rehabilitation type program because she recently went through a psychoanalysis with this organization that does rehabilitation for employment.
Yes.
And she was diagnosed.
No,
she was diagnosed as not being a candidate for post-secondary education. She has an eighth grade reading ability. She has a fourth grade math ability. So I stayed because after she was released from the hospital, it's when I could or could not have accepted the job. I stayed because her doctors said they did not feel it would be good for me to leave her here under her current circumstances. I didn't feel it would be good for me to do that. I felt as though I'd be abandoning her.
Yeah.
So I stayed on and soldiered on and did the motherly correct thing to do.
Mm.
It hasn't improved the situation at all. I do feel closer to her at times, but not overall. The psychoanalytical evaluation came through. And I read it, and she was deemed hostile toward me, quite frankly, by the psychiatrist. And I look at it, and I say, what good did it do me? I called the people in New Mexico today.
Yeah.
And threw my hat back in the ring. I don't know if that's going to be even feasible at this point. But I need to try to open a discussion with them again.
Yeah. Good for you, because what you've actually done is put yourself in the equation rather than saying, no, I have to subordinate everything I want and need for myself.
Right. I'm scared. I'm scared of which way it will go either way. But I knew the time had come I had to do this. The time has come that I really had to do this.
Yes. So in a sense, however this pans out, it could be a win-win situation for you. Whichever way. Yeah. And that's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
And I commend your courage for doing that, because that's a huge step forward for you.
Yeah, I had to take a very deep breath before I did it.
Yeah. But the thing is, your relationship with your daughter, your future, is not going to be decided in one step and in one day. Everything evolves.
That's a good point, and I have to remind myself of that, yeah.
Yes. You don't know how things will be a year from now. You don't know how you and your daughter will move forward. None of us know this,
right.
knows this stuff.
True.
And that's really important. And we don't, and obviously you believe that your commitment to your daughter is the best thing for her. And you have been very committed to her, and you will be very committed to her again. And at this point in time, it may be that, you know, it's not necessarily the best way forward for either of you, what you've been doing.
Yeah, that's the conclusion that I've come to within the last 6 months.
I think that's fantastic, because it was one that you fought tooth and nail.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And
yeah.
as you know, with my own circumstances, with my own daughter, I don't say this lightly. I mean, I've also had to step back and say, my daughter's choices are not what I would have chosen to be the best for her. But actually, it's not for me to know.
Right.
I can't read the future any more than anybody else, and
exactly.
we all have to trust that there's more than one way of things working out well. And
okay.
I think that's really quite important, that as women who've been through scenarios which are always disastrous, an abuser will always tell you that everything you do is disastrous, you do forget that things can turn out well, and that things can turn out well in lots of different ways. So choices don't have to be disastrous. Even if they're difficult now, it doesn't mean that that's not the first step towards a solution that you hadn't envisaged, but which is a good solution.
Right.
Does
right.
that make
sense? I think absolutely. And I think that's the mindset that I had when I decided finally today that I was going to start pursuing this again.
And that's fantastic. You really do sound in a different place tonight. You really do.
It feels a bit different. Yeah, it feels a bit different. I've heard nothing back from them yet. What
yes.
I hear back, if I hear back, I don't know. I will pursue it a few times just so that they know I'm truly interested.
Yeah.
But I had to take the step.
Yeah, and I'd like to say for everybody who's going to be listening to this call that one of the hideous things about the predicament of being paralyzed by an abusive relationship is this being so horrendously stuck until one day something happens and you just have to, something makes you feel you just have to move forward, does it not?
Mm-hmm. That's exactly it. And
yes.
it hasn't happened to me in one fell swoop.
No.
But it's been the eventuality, and it's been building, especially over the last 6 months.
Yeah. I do remember how incredibly stuck you were, how you just felt there was absolutely no way that, you know, you were in quicksand, virtually up to your nose, and there was
mm-hmm.
nowhere else. And that is changing.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And it is
slowly.
A small miracle, it really is.
it's thanks to you and working with you, because I could not get there on my own.
Well, I'm delighted to have a hand in it. It gives me such pleasure, because I'm totally committed to doing this. Is Wilhelmina still with us?
I don't know.
Wilhelmina?
I think I must have lost her.
Yeah.
Are you here?
Yeah. I'm here.
Oh, lovely.
Good.
You're so quiet. So what have you got from tonight's class? What would you like to comment about it?
Well, I'm surprised that some of the things that you were covering are also things that were starting to surface. You know, I wasn't really identifying them, but just that the idea that the things that I felt were wrong about me, I looked at them and I thought, well, it's not really so wrong. And then it was like, but it's wrong if it's so exaggerated. And so I thought, it's all, good qualities are exaggerated because you're really trying to outdo the bad or outdo, to fill it up so that it can finally respond back to you. And so that was pretty surprising to me that was already starting to happen. And then to lower the exaggeration of any of those qualities to see that they can function reasonably well still. It's not like things are all broken. And that things aren't so intense and so frightening. So that you just lower it all and it's not inflamed anymore. And it certainly feels better. And it allows you to feel what is actually going on.
Yeah. And a couple of things I'd like to say. These overdone strengths are great qualities. There's nothing wrong with them. It's not helpful to you to bestow them lavishly on someone who doesn't appreciate them. And when you don't do that, when you learn not to do that, you then have the choice of using those strengths appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
But at the moment, you've been using them furiously as if trying to push a massive boulder up the mountainside. You know, if I'm incredibly nice to you, you'll eventually be nice back. No, it's not going to happen. And the other thing, Wilhelmina, which I hope you won't mind my pointing out to you, is that when you talk about what's going on, it often, although you're owning it, your language often becomes quite impersonal. So you talk about qualities and you talk about the person. The person, I suspect, is your abuser.
Mm-hmm.
And the words I and he and my and his tend not to come into it very much.
Oh.
And it's really quite useful when you own that. Because when you hear yourself owning it sometimes, it really helps you to say, I'm not sure that sits well with me anymore and I can start to change it.
Mm. Can you give an example, like what I just said? And then I know what you're talking about. I just am thinking, wow, let me hear this, like the way I would say it and the way it would be more appropriate to say it.
Well, it's quite difficult to find anything. I have noticed you saying the person when you mean your abuser.
Mm.
And it's... Sorry, nothing's... I can't quite repeat what you said.
Yeah.
But it's almost like because you're a lovely person and you don't like having ugly emotions, you put everything as far away from as you can.
Oh, you know, and I think that's something that I've noticed I do also because of the children. He's not here. And trying to find the right way to talk about him and not sound like I'm going to impose anything critical, although everybody knows everything that's going on. I mean, it's not, it's all shared, but I still do that. So I probably do that everywhere. Mm-hmm.
And that is a bit of a tough one because depending on how he is with them, if you try and present too sanitized a view of him to them, it will just confuse them.
And that's what I did, and he treated them very badly. That's what woke me up.
Yes.
So they say, Mom, don't defend. Okay,
yes.
I won't defend. But in the beginning, it was extreme because I was afraid that if I said anything, even if it was truthful, I'd say anything that was not nice or not first qualified as, well, it could be this way, then the courts would never let me divorce. or I would be being a bad mom and he would get the kids. And
yeah,
it was just frightening. And it's not over, so I will... Yeah, I will look at that. That's very interesting. And it does send a very mixed message because we all know he's done this. He's done it to all of us.
So
mm-hmm.
you can be a little more, well, you can start being a little bit more honest with them.
Yeah.
If you spent your time saying to them, your father is a lying, two-faced, nasty, you know, spiteful git, that would not be particularly helpful to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But if you just acknowledge that he's not always behaved as well as he could towards them, that's true, and that means that it's, in a sense, honoring their perception.
Yeah. Yeah.
As regards the fear of being accused of not being a good enough mother, I can... you know, not a fit mother. I can really relate to that one.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the kind of stuff that the head worker does.
Yeah.
The fact is, you've got many, many people who will stand up for you and say that you are a good mother, including your children.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a fear. That fear is, you know, a wound of not trusting your own perceptions and what other people tell you.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is, I would have thought that you could bring massive proof that you are a good enough parent, and the courts would be very, very unlikely to not take that into account.
Mm-hmm.
And also, not only are you a good enough parent, a good enough mother, you would fight tooth and nail for your children, wouldn't you?
Oh, yes.
Nobody's ever going to take them away from you, and you're just going to sit back and say, oh. So I think you're living with a degree of fear,
mm-hmm.
which is your baggage, and which you would not even allow to come about in reality.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Yeah. So it's about starting to liberate who you are from who you fear you might be.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I was going on about overdone strengths, it was really for you to get an idea of how awesome these strengths are. Because do not underestimate the strength needed to survive in an abusive relationship. It's massive. Life, you know, any relationship has its challenges. And I did an interview a while back with a lovely lady called Anne Milford, who wrote How Not to Marry the Wrong Guy, I think. It's a fabulous book. And she managed to get out of a very unpleasant relationship just before she was due to marry a man who was, I think, quite abusive.
Mm-hmm.
And in due course, she married a wonderful man. He had a very serious health problem when she had, I think, two children under the age of three or something.
Mm-hmm.
So life was really, really difficult. He couldn't work. She couldn't work because she had these two tiny children. He had this dreadful condition, and he was in a very bad state, and he had to work. So life was really, really hard for them.
Mm-hmm.
in a lot of ways, but it was still a very loving, supportive relationship. And she had the most immense regard for the fact that despite being as ill as he was, he went out because he loved his wife and his family, and he was doing what he could to earn the money to keep them secure.
Mm-hmm.
So the point I'm making is that in relationships where marriage is functional and two people actually love one another, hard as it may be, there is not, you know, there is this love and care that is supporting you, whereas in an abusive relationship, it really is incredibly hard. And the strengths that we have to survive that are massive, and we tend to underestimate them so massively. And when we start to realize what strengths we actually have and think, hey, I can use these strengths for my survival and for my kids' benefit, it changes everything.
Yeah.
And the footnote is just that Anne Milford's husband got over his illness, which is really nice. But, you know, they had very hard times, but differently hard.
Mm-hmm.
So, does that help?
Yeah, it really does. It, it helps in lots and lots of ways to be able to see a more realistic and clearer view of oneself when it's not all...
You've just done it.
Yeah, like it's all, oh, what did I do?
A much more realistic and clear view of oneself.
Ah.
Myself, Wilhelmina. Myself.
Ah.
I don't think you put yourself in the picture very much.
I don't. I hide. That's been a big thing I've been working on.
Yeah.
How I hide things. How I hide where I am, who I am. Wow.
And you hide linguistically.
Yes. Huh.
Yes. Oh, yes. So that's something you can play with, actually becoming aware of when you start drifting off into this oneself thing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, and I'm like sitting here, my goodness. Okay.
Yes. Great.
I'm afraid.
Right.
I'm afraid to say myself. I'm afraid to say with me out there. I tell you, even thinking about it right now, it's just like, whoo, it's so massive. Like, I don't know what I think's going to come at me, but it's like him.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's not, because you are learning. You will learn how to defend yourself and keep these people away. And while you were dialing in a second time because of the echo on the phone, Laurie and I were having this little chat and saying, oh, she's such a lovely person, isn't she? Because that's the way you come across.
Mm-hmm.
You are delightful. People enjoy you. So I would stop. I would entertain the idea of hiding a little less.
Uh-huh.
And because there are a few unsafe people around, yeah, and you will learn how to deal with them. And there are a lot of people who just want to enjoy you. And that goes for all of us.
Yeah.
So, is that a good note on which to end tonight's call?
Yeah, it's great. I'm going to watch for that.
Yes. And watch for people enjoying you. And you can do the same thing, Laurie.
Thank you.
Whether you like it or not. And good luck with the job.
Thank you
job
very much.
Application. And I look forward to speaking to you next week. And I can actually post the call up now because, you know, having tied Steve to my office chair, I now know how to do it.
It's accomplished finally, is it?
It is, but the trouble is he enjoyed being tied to the office chair so much he didn't want to leave.
He probably enjoyed being fed too, didn't he?
God, he loved it. He's just moved house, and I was just plying him with massive quantities of food. And, he obviously hadn't eaten for 4 days, and he was so pleased.
Oh, dear.
It was good fun.
You're certainly a wonderful caregiver.
Aren't we all?
I know. That does tend to be characteristic, too, doesn't it?
It does, yes. But you can... And it's all good stuff. The thing is actually learning to say no when you want to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Boundaries. I'm loving this conversation, and it's 12 minutes past midnight here.
Oh, dear.
So I shall say good night and see you all next week.
Okay. Good night.
Good night, Annie. Good night, Wilhelmina.
Good night, Annie.
Bye.
Bye-bye.